Thank you, Madam Marshal. Will you please call the case?
Calling the case of State of Minnesota versus Marcel Dylan Zephyr, court file number A-200757.
Good morning, Mr. Butler and Mr. Smith. I know that you both are experienced and know how we do these Zoom hearings. You'll each have 15 minutes. Mr. Butler, 5 minutes for rebuttal for you. If at any time you can't hear us or there are technical difficulties, we haven't had any this morning, but please let us know so that we can stop the clock. And at the beginning of your argument, please state your name for the record. Mr. Butler, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant Marcel Zephyr. This case involves Mr. Zephyr being on trial for his life. He faced a 12-year prison sentence and a lifetime of conditional release on the accusation that he had sexually abused a 9-year-old girl. It's about the most serious accusation the state can level against a person, maybe even including murder. At his trial, Mr. Zephyr's court-appointed attorney did not cross-examine half the state's witnesses, including the complainant, the complainant's treatment provider, the forensic interviewer, and a police officer who was called as the sole witness to account by hearsay for one of Mr. Zephyr's prior bad acts. To the state's other four witnesses, counsel asked a total of 27 questions. He filed no written motions or written responses to the state's motions. His opening statement was one paragraph long. During his closing argument, he told the jury he, counsel, thought the complainant's testimony was, quote, very powerful, hard to watch, hard to listen to. And he did not object to repeated instances of prosecutorial misconduct, some of which we contend is misconduct, some of which the state even admits was misconduct. And as a result of this, Mr. Zephyr will spend the rest of his life in the custody of the Department of Corrections. This court should reverse Mr. Zephyr's convictions for either reasons two or three cited in our brief, the evidentiary issues or the prosecutorial misconduct. I think that's all been adequately briefed. There's some moving parts on issue one that I'd like to discuss, and that is the erroneous denial of an evidentiary hearing on Mr. Zephyr's post-conviction petition claiming ineffective assistance of counsel. The post-conviction court had before it on the ineffective assistance
issue. Mr. Butler, I'm sorry, yes, and before you go forward. So I just want to be clear. I think you said so, but looking at your brief and specifically the table of contents, you have two issues in Roman, under Roman 2, 2A and 2B, 2A concerning essentially the videotaped interview, 2B concerning expert testimony. I just want to clarify that you, in your briefing and today in your argument, you're asking this court to reverse for the independent reasons that the district court committed error at trial in admitting that evidence. Is that your argument?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Butler, below in the post-conviction hearing, the judge wrote about the 404B evidence that he admitted, but you're not contesting that ruling in your appeal, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That issue is not in the brief.
Thank you.
So as I see, just to clarify, as I see issues two and three, they're basically merits issues at this point. The judge at post-conviction did not contend that there was some sort of trial strategy or that the trial counsel's performance was not deficient. The judge said, basically, I admitted the statements under 801 D1 properly. I had allowed the expert under 702 properly, and whatever was going on with the misconduct doesn't entitle him to a new trial. So those are the issues that are in front of this court at this point. I think on those issues are the merits issues.
Well, then with regard to trial counsel objecting, you think incorrectly on the hearsay argument, that would go to issue one?
It would go, to the extent there's a concern about it, it would go to issue one. I read the post-conviction court's order as saying that basically he understood trial counsel to be objecting to all aspects of 801, and that he, the trial judge, would have admitted the evidence, you know, basically no matter what the defense attorney said. So I don't want to give up anything if this court does remand for an evidentiary hearing on ineffective assistance. Perhaps some of that is still alive, but the court can reverse the conviction and order a new trial on either of the merits of issues two and three. And I think the misconduct is actually quite for lack of a better word, bad in this case. This is a very short trial involving a naturally emotional incident. And you had the prosecutor in this case repeatedly not only asking the jury to put itself in the alleged victim's shoes, which the state has conceded is misconduct in the closing, but from voir dire through the end of closing, making what the brief calls emotionally manipulative arguments to the jury about the complainant in this case, about her age, about what she may have been interested in, repeatedly using the word rape, which is not a word we often see in Minnesota criminal sexual conduct cases, violent rape. I think the one that stands out from the closing is the prosecutor saying, telling the jury to send a message, that's not her exact words, I'm paraphrasing, send a message to the defendant, send a message to the victim, rather, with your verdict that no 9-year-old girl should ever be raped. And of course, the contrary of that is if the jury finds the defendant not guilty, then they're sending a message that 9-year-old girls should be raped. And of course, no one thinks that. That is not the issue that's in front of the jury. And it is misconduct to suggest to the jury that that's the kind of message, that that's what their verdict will do.
So Mr. Butler, you disagree with the district court who found that voir dire and opening was within the, it was still on the rails, so to speak.
I do, Your Honor. Your Honor.
And the state concedes that the closing was improper.
The state, I'll let Mr. Smith can obviously speak for himself. The state concedes, I believe, that one paragraph of the closing was misconduct. I believe they would contend otherwise for the rest of it. And I would put the issue to this court. I mean, the transcript says what it says. The misconduct case law is very clear. I think this court is very experienced dealing with misconduct. You know what the prosecutor here said, and I would suggest that you find that it was misconduct.
Mr. Butler, one more question to kind of clarify the scope of your argument. So, in the post-conviction petition, your client alleged that trial counsel was deficient, his performance was deficient for 5 reasons, and I believe that in your appellate brief, you are pursuing just one of those 5. The one reason counsel was, you would like us to reverse and remand for an evidentiary hearing as to one issue, whether he was his performance was deficient by not cross-examining the alleged victim. Am I correct on that?
You are correct, Your Honor. That is the one issue that the post-conviction court said was trial strategy, and therefore performance was not deficient. All of the other issues, the other 4 reasons you mentioned, this is what I was just discussing with Judge Riley a little bit, the post-conviction court basically said, it doesn't matter what counsel did because you lose on the merits. If this court disagrees with that, then I think you can remand it for any issue you want to. But it is correct to say that our primary concern on remand, if there is a remand for an evidentiary hearing, is with the failure to cross-examine the complainant and to otherwise challenge the state's case.
My understanding of the post-conviction order is a little bit different. I believe that the district, my recollection from having read the post-conviction order is that the judge analyzed all 5 of the arguments, reasons asserted why trial counsel had deficient performance, and said that there was no deficient performance, and so it was the first Strickland prong, not the second, with one exception and I believe, I can't remember now, but there was one issue where there may have been a prejudice analysis where the post-conviction court cross-referenced the discussion at the end of the order about cumulative error, but it sounds like you read it differently. That sounds like you think the post-conviction court resolved all 5 on the second Strickland prong. What's the difference here?
Sure. Let me be clear. And I think in the end, I'm not sure it makes much of a difference, Your Honor, but here's how I read the order. I read the order as I'm going to call it issues, ineffective assistance issues. Issue 1, failure to cross-examine. Post-conviction court says no deficient performance because it was strategy. Now, we strongly disagree with that, and we think there needs to be an evidentiary hearing so counsel can explain, if there was a strategy, what it was. The rest of the issues, I think the fairest way to read the order is the post-conviction court sort of blended the two the two substantive matters. So sometimes the post-conviction court said counsel's performance wasn't deficient because his objection would have been overruled and I would have admitted the evidence. Sometimes the post-conviction court said I understood counsel's objection to be a proper one and therefore no deficient performance. Also, I would have admitted the expert, I would have admitted the hearsay. So I think on those and on the misconduct, I think it's the same thing. Counsel's performance wasn't deficient and or no prejudice because most of this, the post-conviction court said, wasn't misconduct. So whether you pin that to prong one, deficient performance, or prong two, prejudice, I think you still come out the same way, which is a focus on the correctness of the initial order. Again, I would say that if there's some confusion about that, I don't think this order, post-conviction court's order, is a model of clarity. And so if what the court wants to do is say, we don't quite know what's here and what's not here, other than perhaps some of the misconduct, you can still order a new trial on the misconduct grounds, or you can remand for an evidentiary hearing at least on the failure to cross issue and let the post-conviction court, sort out what other potential ineffective assistance issues are still open in front of it and clarify its own order. At least on the failure to cross issue, because that's the one thing that was squarely rejected by the post-conviction court on a matter of no deficient performance because this was supposedly trial strategy. And our concern with that is that the post-conviction court doesn't know the most important fact about failure to cross, and that is the question of why. It knows the four W's, who, what, when, and where. But it doesn't know the fifth W, why. Why did trial counsel fail to cross-examine the complainant in this case?
We have the Pearson case and the Francis v. State case that say that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel cannot be based on counsel's decision not to cross-examine a witness. It's a trial strategy, unreviewable. How do you distinguish those cases?
Sure. The specifics of those cases are addressed in the reply brief, Your Honor. Pearson, the lawyer, does cross-examine a bunch of witnesses for one thing. But more to the point, I think the Minnesota Supreme Court sometimes shorthands what the standard is. The standard under Strickland versus Washington is that a strategic decision undertaken after a thorough investigation of law and facts relevant to plausible options are virtually unchallengeable. That's Strickland at page 7 or 690. So there's a bunch of qualifiers there. Number one, there has to be a thorough investigation of law and facts. We have no evidence there was a thorough investigation of law and facts in this case. Number two, there has to be a strategic choice. So sometimes a lawyer could say, and if you look at the post-conviction court's order on page 11, the post-conviction court speculates on why a lawyer might choose not to cross-examine a complainant. And that might be right. That might be why this lawyer chose not to cross-examine this complainant. Or a lawyer, and I don't want to go too far outside the record here, but let's say hypothetically, a lawyer were to testify that once the complainant started crying on the witness stand, he panicked and he didn't know what to do. And so he just panicked and said, I have no questions. If that's what happened, then that's not a strategic choice made after a thorough investigation of law and facts. That's the wrong answer. That is not a strategic choice. We can consider on the merits whether that's deficient performance or not, but it's certainly not a strategic choice.
Mr. Butler, I think that I understand your argument, and I think that it relies on good principles, but it seems like our state Supreme Court has on some occasions made the determination that something is trial strategy without there being a factual record, either a testimony or an affidavit. Francis is one such case, and I believe that there are others too. I have them out of reach behind me.
Sure.
It seems to me that that Supreme Court case law would indicate that it was not error for the post-conviction court to do so in this case. And is one possible justification for that the fact that the judge presided over the trial? He's not a witness per se, but he he experienced the trial and has perhaps some valid observations about what occurred and a good memory perhaps. And so maybe it's inherent in some of the case law that the judge presiding in a post-conviction can rely on his or her knowledge of the trial in forming those conclusions sometimes.
There's a lot to answer in 30 seconds. I don't dispute the general idea that the judge can rely on his observations. I do dispute the idea that the judge can assign to trial counsel reasons that trial counsel hasn't testified to, which is what happened in this case. I would also suggest that this court look to its own opinions in Owens and Doby, which are cited in a supplemental authority letter, in which this court remands for evidentiary hearings on ineffective assistance issues for matters of what could be called trial strategy. In Doby, there's a whole bunch of stuff the trial lawyer does, including question his own client about the client's criminal history. And the court says, we need to know why you did that. So remand it.
Owens' failure to make a suppression motion. I think Judge Randall called that a stunning direct examination.
He did. He did. And if you look at Owens, I see I'm out of time. I'll just say briefly that if you look at Owens, it's a little more compact failure to make a suppression motion. But the court there, I believe it's Judge Shellhouse, I could be wrong, says, well, we don't know why you didn't make the motion. Maybe you didn't make the motion because you thought you'd lose, or maybe you'd make the motion because you didn't know about the case law. So remanded to have you testify on why you didn't make the motion. That's all we'd ask for here. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. I want to jump right into the question about what actually did the post-conviction court do in its order, particularly with regard to the claims involving the failure to object to prior consistent statements on the grounds that the credibility had not been challenged, and regarding objections to the expert's testimony. And I disagree with Mr. Butler that the court resolved certainly the inconsistent the consistent statement grounds on the basis that it would have ruled the same regardless, and that it reached the merits of the underlying issue. It did no such thing. The court concluded, I think, as a matter of historical fact, that counsel made the objection on hearsay grounds, and that the trial court understood as a matter of fact that that objection included the argument that the complainant's credibility had not been challenged. And I read the post-conviction court's order as concluding that on that basis, the claim failed because counsel's performance was not objectively unreasonable. The question of whether the trial court would have made the same ruling on the objection anyway goes to prejudice, not to the objective performance. And the post-conviction court absolutely does not say in its order denying the petition that it would have reached the same conclusion about the consistent statements if there would have been a proper objection as appellant claims. It simply says it understood the trial counsel to have been making that objection as a matter of fact, and analyzed it accordingly. Because the claim there is that counsel was ineffective for making the objection on a specific grounds, and the post-conviction court found that he did make that objection, and the trial court understood the objection to include those grounds, there's no analysis of the merits of the objection, and that claim fails without getting to the question of the merits. So I don't think the post-conviction court reached the merits of that issue. And quite frankly, I certainly did not understand appellant to be making an argument that the trial court, as opposed to the post-conviction court, had abused its discretion in making the ruling. I didn't understand that from the brief as a separate grounds for relief here. And I don't think that was clear at all in either the principal brief or the reply brief. I would say that the issue of the expert's testimony, the post-conviction court treated in essentially the same manner. It it said that the trial counsel objected on the grounds of lacking foundation for delayed reporting, even though he didn't say the exact words of lacking foundation or reliability, and analyzed that issue. It didn't then go on to comment about the merits of the issue had he made some talismanic incantation. Instead, it simply said, I read the order as saying on both of those issues, trial counsel made the objections that appellant is now trying to claim he didn't make, and therefore there's no basis for ineffective assistance of counsel on these grounds. With regard to prosecutorial error, I think we need to talk about an elephant in the room here, which is the fourth prong of the modified plain error test. As I highlighted in my motion to strike and in my principal brief, the appellant made no argument regarding the fourth prong of the modified plain error test in his principal brief. That argument is a prong on which the appellant bears the burden of persuasion. In his reply brief, appellant candidly, I guess, says that he doesn't have to make an argument on that prong in his principal brief. He can wait until the state has made an argument as to whether the alleged error did not affect the defendant's substantial rights. And it's only then that he has to assert an argument that the fourth prong is satisfied. That argument is preposterous. If he can save that argument for a reply brief on a prong that he carries the burden of persuasion on, he can completely deprive the state of a meaningful opportunity to address that fourth prong of the modified plain error test. And that makes a mockery of judicial proceedings. He's simply saying that apparently the state's supposed to anticipate what arguments the appellant might make on a prong on which he bears the burden of persuasion and not have an opportunity to respond to his actual arguments. That might carry some weight if it were a prong on which the state bore the burden, like the prong about the substantial rights prong. But that's not the case with the fourth prong. Moreover, the argument appellant has made for satisfying the fourth prong is that he didn't receive a fair trial. Therefore, the alleged error calls the integrity or public reputation of the judicial proceedings, as opposed to judicial proceedings, into question. But that collapses prong three into prong four. And our Supreme Court has been abundantly clear that you cannot collapse those two prongs into the same thing. It's not simply, was this proceeding?
Mr. Smith.
Yes.
If I may, I mean, just, I would like to turn your attention. I'm sure you're going to get there, but we only have limited time. And I'd like to talk with you about the question about whether there should have been an evidentiary hearing on the failure to cross-examine the complaining witness. And it's this question of, that we were talking with Mr. Butler about, you know, how much, or do we give more deference on this question of, was it a strategic decision or not, to the post-conviction court, because the post-conviction court also was a district court. Because just looking at the post-conviction order, the judge here clearly attributes, you know, possible strategic reasons for not doing the cross-examination. So help me, is there any sort of case law or precedent said, and we should like give that more deference because it was the district court, as opposed to following what Mr. Butler was saying, was like, that there was no reason given here.
So I wouldn't necessarily say that we give the post-conviction court more deference in that, because it was sitting as the trial court. But I think that what we have to look at here is the whole context of ineffective assistance of counsel and how these claims are analyzed, and the fact that this is post-conviction relief. So first of all, it's post-conviction relief. So the petitioner bears the burden generally of demonstrating that he's entitled to relief and pleading or alleging sufficient facts to entitle him to relief. And those allegations have to be more than simple conclusory assertions in the petition. Appellant hasn't alleged any facts beyond the bare fact of the failure to cross-examine.
Well, but Mr. Smith, if I may, shouldn't we be able to look at the fact, you know, in the context, I think Mr. Butler was suggesting that not only, I mean, while this evidentiary hearing is focused on no cross-examination of the complaining witnesses, there is the context that there were a number of witnesses that counsel didn't cross at all. And then as cross-examination for others was pretty short. Isn't that context that should be considered in making that decision?
I don't think it's context that should be considered because the petitioner didn't allege that as ineffective assistance of counsel. What he alleged specifically was that his counsel was ineffective for failing to cross-examine the complainant. And there was evidence in the record as it existed at the time he filed his petition that gives rise to an eminently reasonable explanation for that action. And it's his obligation to plead some facts that would overcome the presumption, the strong presumption that counsel's performance is effective. I think that's especially true where you have the state of the law in Minnesota as it is now, where our Supreme Court has clearly said that the decision of counsel's decision whether to cross-examine a witness is a matter of unreviewable trial strategy. I know Mr. Butler argues that maybe that's not completely consistent with Strickland or not as finessed as Strickland, but the fact of the matter is that this court and the district court are bound by the Minnesota Supreme Court's statement as to what the law is in Minnesota. And our Supreme Court has repeatedly said that decisions about whether to cross-examine witnesses are unreviewable trial strategy. If you think you have a case as a post-conviction relief petitioner where you should be able to overcome that bar, you've got to plead facts as to why this wasn't trial strategy. And counsel for appellant, post-conviction counsel, appellate counsel for appellant could have asked his attorney why he didn't do that and alleged in the petition those facts. There's nothing that would prohibit him from alleging those. He could have obtained an affidavit from trial counsel as to why or why he didn't do those things. It was his burden as the post-conviction relief petitioner pursuing a claim where there's a presumption of effectiveness to make those pleadings. And in the absence of those pleadings and allegations, the district court is not obliged to grant an evidentiary hearing. He simply hasn't pled any facts that entitle him to relief. The Minnesota Supreme Court recently in Allwine used the language of failure to state a claim, where a petition for post-conviction relief alleges ineffective assistance of counsel based on a matter of trial strategy. The petition fails to state a claim without more. And I think that's why there is no error in the district court denying this petition without an evidentiary hearing on the question of cross-examining the victim.
Why is trial strategy not something that is for the state to assert in its answer, as you did, rather than for the petitioner? I mean, the petition does say counsel did not cross-examine the complaining witness. She was the only other person present other than Mr. Zafir. Why is that not enough to put it in play? And then it's up for the state to include that fact in its response.
I think why it's not is because we're talking about ineffective assistance of counsel. We're talking about issues of the attorney-client privilege. And I have no power to compel trial counsel to provide me with answers to questions before I file an answer. In fact, I may even have no right to inquire as to those strategic decisions. And I think that's precisely why these things aren't unreviewable. The parties, this is not like the Fagan context, where this is a kind of information that's particularly within the position of the state, and the state should be in the burden of pleading that in its answer. Rather, I mean, certainly I did plead it in my answer, but I don't think it's the state's burden to plead that and demonstrate some facts that make it so.
Mr. Smith, you seem to fault appellate counsel or the appellant's counsel at the post-conviction portion of the proceedings when she didn't get affidavits from other criminal defense lawyers or maybe from the trial counsel. Do you think that it's incumbent on appellants in post-conviction proceedings to do more than put forth a motion?
I think the law requires them to allege specific facts. I'm not saying that as a matter of law they have to submit affidavits. I want to be clear that I'm not suggesting that. I am suggesting that that's one way that you could allege the facts necessary to entitle you to an evidentiary hearing, and it's certainly the way I've seen some attorneys go about pursuing post-conviction relief claims on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel. So I think it's an effective way of doing so. I'm not claiming that 590 requires that as a matter of law. But what I am saying is that you, at least in the petition, have to allege specific facts that, if proven, would overcome the presumption of effectiveness, or in this case, the default position that this is a matter of trial strategy. The law is clear that you can't simply have unsupported assertions to entitle you to an evidentiary hearing. And that's what we have here, is an unsupported assertion that this couldn't possibly have been a trial strategy. Well, but the record supports a conclusion that it is a trial strategy, and there are no facts in the record that would demonstrate or at least give rise to a real question of fact as to whether it's a trial strategy. So I think the point of the statute is to provide some notice and an idea of what the facts to be proven at the evidentiary hearing are. And I see my time has expired. I would simply ask this court to affirm the appellant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Butler?
Thank you. I'm afraid that my friend, Mr. Smith, and I are going to have to disagree about the burden. And I would cite the court to Minnesota Statute 590.02, Subdivision 1.1, which says that an evidentiary hearing must be held on a petition unless the files conclusively, and that's a really big word to the Minnesota Supreme Court. If you look at the Nix case, they really focus on that word, conclusively show that the petitioner is not entitled to relief. So when Mr. Smith says that the petition has to prove that these actions were not trial strategy, well, the statute says the exact opposite. And the statute says all we have to show is that these were actions, and we have to allege that they were not trial strategy. I would also back up to what the statute requires of a petition. The post-conviction petition under Section 590.02, Subdivision 1.1, cannot contain argument and cannot contain citation to the record. In other words, it is a bare bones document. It is just supposed to contain facts. That's it. Now, there's a few more filings in this case because the post-conviction judge asked for a memo from the defense attorney, and the defense attorney provided the judge with one. But that does not change the requirement of 590, which is all you have to do is say, these are the facts, no argument, no anything else. And the judge then has to have an evidentiary hearing unless the facts conclusively show that we're not entitled to one. That was not true here. I would also say Mr. Smith said that he can't compel anything from trial counsel. Neither can I. Okay, trial counsel is a witness at this point. Trial counsel is not representing the defendant. And I can't make trial counsel talk to me. And I can't make trial counsel sign an affidavit. And I can't make trial counsel do anything other than show up in court under subpoena when we have the hearing and he's compelled to testify. So this idea, I realize there's been a walk back here for the idea that affidavits are required, but this idea that affidavits are, oh, would be so helpful. Well, they would be, but I don't have that kind of power. The petitioner doesn't have that kind of power. And more to the point, the statute doesn't require it. Ultimately, the state's position here is circular, that failure to cross is trial strategy. Because it's trial strategy, you don't get a hearing because you don't get a hearing on trial strategy. Well, we don't know if it's trial strategy. What if the lawyer was sleeping while the witness was testifying? What if the lawyer was drunk while the witness was testifying? What if the lawyer was inexperienced and didn't know he could ask the witness any questions? What if the lawyer panicked when the witness started crying and just didn't know what to do, so said no questions. None of those are strategic decisions. So you can't take a category of things that happen during a trial and say, automatically, under no circumstances can you ever ask a lawyer why he or she didn't do this. And this, if you look at the Hinton versus Alabama case, it's really on point. Hinton versus Alabama involves the selection of an expert witness. And the United States Supreme Court says, look, normally the selection of an expert witness is quintessential trial strategy. We would never second guess a lawyer's decision on which expert to select. But in this case, the reason that trial counsel selected this particular incompetent expert is because trial counsel didn't know that he could get more money from the district court to hire a better expert. That's the deficient performance. It's deficient performance to call this expert because trial counsel made a legal error. He didn't know that. You have to look behind the decision itself for the reason for the decision.
Well, isn't your argument in tension with the state Supreme Court's decision in Francis and other cases? I mean, how do we reconcile what you're saying and what Francis does?
I think you could look, again, you could look to your own opinions where you have done exactly that. I would also say that the same thing is true in Nix. So if you look at the Supreme Court's opinion in Nix, decisions about which evidence to pursue, which lines of defense to pursue, those are quintessential trial strategy decisions. Frankly, everything a lawyer does is a trial strategy decision.
Tell me about Nix.
Just in Nix, the Supreme Court remands for an evidentiary hearing because we need to know why.
I think, as I recall, the trial counsel did testify or give a statement explaining I think he just said that he just missed it. He made a mistake. And so that was not strategic in any way. It was simply he admitted to a shortcoming, I believe.
I believe you're right, Your Honor, but that's exactly what I'm looking for here. Because Mr. Nix could produce that statement from trial counsel before the hearing, he gets a hearing. I can't produce anything from trial counsel. I can't make trial counsel say anything one way or the other. And the question is, I see I'm out of time, Judge Riley, but do you mind if I finish my thought?
Please finish.
Thank you, Your Honor. The question is, do the files conclusively show that the petitioner is not entitled to relief? So in other words, if the state had some on-the-record statement from trial counsel saying, here's why I did what I did. I was concerned about 1, 2, and 3, and those concerns are very reasonable, and that's why I didn't cross-examine it. If that statement existed in the record, perhaps then the files and records would show that the petitioner is not entitled to relief. But right now we have nothing in the record explaining the decision. And when that happens, that's why we need to have an evidentiary hearing.
Judge Riley, could I please ask Mr. Butler one more question about one other issue that we haven't addressed so far? Thank you. And that, Mr. Butler, referring to the 801D1B issue, the case law says that credibility must be challenged. I'm not aware of any case law, precedential case law or otherwise, where an appellate court has held that credibility was not, let me say, a case such as this, a crim sex case, but where credibility was not challenged. It seems to be either there are in the record it's expressly challenged, or if it's not so explicit, I think it might be fair to say that appellate courts might say that it's just inherently an issue. It's obviously an issue because only two people were present and the complaining witnesses' testimony is, it's truth or falsity goes directly to the ultimate issue. So it seems to me that it's a pretty low bar for that issue. Do you have any response to my comments on that issue?
I do. I have a few responses, Your Honor. I agree that it's a low bar. I do not know of any case like this where there was zero cross-examination of the complainant and where nothing in the opening statement or other examination of other witnesses openly challenged the complainant's credibility. I think there are cases about opening statement. I don't have a problem with that, but look to counsel's opening statement here. He doesn't say much. I agree with you on this sort of inherent thing. I think there's some value to that. The problem though, is that the rule requires a challenge. And so if you say, well, look, every lawsuit that goes to trial has a challenge to somebody's credibility, right? That's why we try cases. And so it's got to be something more than the defendant pled guilty or the civil defendant refused to settle, and that's why we're having a trial. Somebody's got to say something along the lines of that witness isn't telling you the truth. That's what opens the door to the prior consistent statements. And I agree it doesn't have to be much, but I think it's got to be more than it was here.
Thank you. And if I may, just one quick follow-up. So comment, the rule does not use the word challenge. I think the Nunn case introduced the word challenge for the first time. Specific follow-up question is, are the closing arguments relevant to our analysis of whether credibility has been challenged?
I'll take your point on Nunn versus the rule, Your Honor. The direct answer to your second question is no. Closing arguments are not relevant because by the time of closing, the evidence had already come in. So once the evidence comes in, it's a totally different story. Defense counsel doesn't have to worry about, you know, whether he's challenging enough or not because the evidence is in. The judge's decision has to be viewed at the time the judge made the decision. Now, if the judge makes a decision and says, okay, you haven't challenged the credibility yet, so I'm not going to allow the prior consistent statements, but hang on. If we get to some point where you do challenge it, state, I'm going to let you recall your witnesses and then it's opened the door. So it's not like a game playing thing here. But I don't think you can say, well, he hadn't challenged the credibility, so the judge maybe wasn't right, but then later he did challenge the credibility, so retroactively the judge was correct. Because you don't know what would have happened had the judge ruled properly in the first instance and kept the prior consistent statements out.
Any more questions from the panel? Thank you very much. Your arguments have been very helpful this morning, and we will have our decision out within 90 days. And this concludes the oral portion of our calendar.